Residence Limited versus GP Credit Company. Mr. Ahrens.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The first matter I would like to address the court is the motion by Orlando Residence to dismiss the appeal on the grounds of lack of case or controversy. I would call to the court's attention or remind the court, depending on the court's awareness, that our reply brief filed on December 1st indicated that we had received, that GP Credit had received communications from the Secretary of State of Oklahoma that the cancellation of GP Credit's articles.
Okay, it's fine. So move on to something else.
Does the court have, I filed.
So go on to another issue, would you?
Okay. The case is here because the principal cause that the case is here is because Orlando refused to accept this court's decisions. In fact,
No, that's not why it's here. Let me ask you, going back into the 90s in this ridiculously protracted and proliferated litigation, is it correct? So the Tennessee court said the only difference between these two Orlando residence companies was that one was owned 98% by Hartage and the other 100%. Is that the jurisdictional issue that you have been pursuing ever since?
I don't recall the specifics, but I understand that they had different partners and therefore were different partnerships. But it has never been the fact that they were that part has never been disputed.
I don't understand you. The Tennessee court held that there was no jurisdictional problem, that these two Orlandos were so similar, common ownership and everything, they were interchangeable. So it didn't matter which one was the party, either one had standing, right?
I believe that was the holding of the Tennessee court.
Oh, sure it was. I don't understand you. Anyway, you said you didn't remember it, so why are you arguing with me? What was the jurisdictional issue?
I believe that the Tennessee appellate court held that the issue of standing had arisen too late to be addressed by the appellate court, and therefore it did not address it on that basis. And it adhered to that decision in later opinions on the grounds of law of the case.
In later opinions, it keeps saying the jurisdictional issue had been settled at the outset by this ruling by the Chancery Court that the two Orlandos were interchangeable. And the Tennessee, the Court of Appeals has steadfastly ruled that jurisdictional issue was resolved and cannot be reopened.
Okay. I understand the context of the question now. They were the same, but the issue was, did the plaintiff in either of the Tennessee courts, was it the owner of the federal judgment? That remains undisturbed, that the plaintiff in those two Tennessee cases was not the owner of the federal judgment. That has never been...
The federal judgment you're talking about? Federal judgment?
Federal
going back
judgment.
To the 90s, what was the federal judgment?
The federal judgment was the stem of all of this. It was a federal judgment obtained on a note against National Residence Corporation.
Well, what do you mean by a federal judgment?
A judgment obtained in the District Court of Tennessee against National Residence Corporation.
When was that?
I believe in 1991 or 19. It was before the 19. I can't remember now. The night before the 1990 proceedings were commenced in Chancery Court in Tennessee. The Chancery Court proceedings were a fraudulent conveyance, in which the plaintiff alleged that it was the owner of the federal judgment and that the defendants had undergone some certain transactions and which were fraudulent conveyances. The standing issue was decided in a second Chancery court case. This is the subjection case. And in that case, the court held that the plaintiff, who was trying in a separate collection proceeding in Tennessee to enforce that federal judgment against assets, was not the owner of the federal judgment and therefore didn't have standing.
Can I try it this way?
Okay.
If the Tennessee courts no longer think that the issue of subject matter jurisdiction may be raised to attack the Tennessee court's own judgment, why should the federal courts use that basis to overturn the Tennessee court ruling?
This comes down to the fundamental difference between the two rules. The one is often referred to as the traditional rule, and the other one I will call the Durfee versus Duke bootstrap rule. And in the traditional rule, the emphasis is on validity rather than finality. And the cases...
No, I don't think there's any such rule. It's too ridiculous. You're saying that a court can decide a jurisdictional issue, you know, like 50 years ago, and you can keep bringing collateral, and 50 years later you can bring a collateral suit and say, oh, that jurisdictional ruling was incorrect.
Well, but this is what Tennessee's...
No, that's insane. That's insane.
But it's what Tennessee...
No, it isn't. You don't have any cases that hold that.
We do. We have...
No, you don't. The Gentry case, which you harp on, does not hold that.
But County of Shelby expressly says, when the court has no jurisdiction of the subject matter, cannot be conferred either by waiver
That's
or...
That's, of course, a general rule. But you have a court. I mean, this isn't like a police court or something. You have the Chancery Court, which is a court that has general jurisdiction over that type of dispute. And it makes a finding about its jurisdiction. That finding, of course, could be reversed and so on. But if it's not, it has collateral estoppel effect. There isn't anything in Tennessee law to contradict, and it wouldn't make any sense because it would mean judgments would have no finality.
Well, but then what the court is doing is saying that this other rule doesn't exist.
That's
and it
correct.
Does exist.
You show me where it's stated.
Well, certainly Shelby says that orders and decrees of a court without subject matter jurisdiction may be collaterally attacked.
That's a general rule, but once there's a finding of jurisdiction by a competent court, that finding, like any other finding, is entitled to collateral estoppel effect. You know, if it's a full and fair proceeding and so on.
Okay, may I quote to you the court from Brown? And it's on our reply brief on page 10.
Which your
great fact brief, that a void judgment has been...
The yellow brief. Now, what page are we on?
Page 10, and it's Brown versus Brown.
Sure, that's fine.
The fact that a void judgment has been reaffirmed on review in an appellate court
But you're not dealing with the issue where there's a finding. There's a litigated issue of jurisdiction and a finding of jurisdiction. That finding is entitled to collateral estoppel effect. Otherwise, right? A finding on a jurisdictional point has the same collateral estoppel status as a finding on any other issue.
But if
there's
the
nothing
court,
in Brown to contradict that in your long quotation from
but
Brown.
But if the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, it can't give it to itself, and that's the point.
No, it has jurisdiction to determine a jurisdictional issue, and once that determination is made, it's binding. Look, suppose we make a finding in a diversity case that there is diversity of citizenship. That's a finding. We are empowered to make that finding. If we make that finding in a full and fair hearing, the finding is entitled to collateral estoppel effect. Otherwise, you could have someone coming along 50 years later and said, no, the Seventh Circuit made a mistake. There wasn't diversity in that case. You can't do that.
But then what is the, why does, the Tennessee courts specifically use the word collaterally attack. They would not use the word collaterally attack.
There are collateral attacks, of course, against void judgments. But you're not focusing on the situation in which there is a jurisdictional finding. So what do you think of my hypothetical case? We find there's diversity jurisdiction. Make a finding. It's argued. We say, no, there is diversity. And 50 years later, someone comes along and says, no, you made a mistake. There wasn't diversity. That judgment is void, and we can reopen the proceeding.
Can I answer the question? The question would be, 50 years later, the judgment would have expired, and it wouldn't be being enforced.
That's not responsive.
Okay, I didn't mean to. I meant to be flip, but seriously, I don't think that that, as a practical matter, is going to occur. Here is a case where...
It doesn't matter whether it's going to occur as a practical matter. As a theoretical matter, it's so preposterous that it can't be the law of any state.
But here, it's as a theoretical matter, what you had was a party without standing, decisions by Tennessee courts in 2003 and 2004 saying that standing isn't part of subject matter jurisdiction. You have these decisions that say you can collaterally attack, and if collateral doesn't mean in another proceeding,
and you are not dealing with a collateral estoppel point.
Well, but
look, even if it were true that such collateral attacks are generally allowed, in this case, the issue of subject matter jurisdiction was itself raised, was itself adjudicated in the Tennessee courts, and in fact, the Tennessee courts subsequently refused to reconsider that issue because the prior determination was the law of the case. So it just isn't... I don't like to use the word disingenuous, but it would be disingenuous, I fear, to argue that under Tennessee law, the federal court can reconsider the subject matter jurisdiction in a collateral attack, even though the Tennessee courts themselves could not themselves reconsider it, you know, where the issue of subject matter jurisdiction has been fully litigated and resolved in the Tennessee court. The federal courts shouldn't be able to reconsider it.
Well, but this exactly is the position taken by ORL and its reliance on Durfee versus Duke that says that a court can bootstrap its own jurisdiction.
It's not.
In other words, a court can declare, well, but Durfee versus Duke is sometimes referred to, it's sometimes referred to as
yeah,
that.
It isn't.
Okay. But where a court can declare that it has subject matter jurisdiction. So what we have is a disagreement.
You're going in circles. You're not getting anywhere.
All right.
There are other strange things about this case. I don't understand your argument about restitution of this bond you want back. What, $150,000? I forgot the number.
Well, it was an intangible.
What did you get for? You never argued this.
I'm sorry.
Pops up in your brief for the first time.
Well, we did argue it. We asked the trial court to give us the money back after the trial court declared there was no jurisdiction over it.
You don't give any argument. What's your basis for getting it back?
Because this court declared that all of the intangibles of NLC belong to GP Credit. And that was an intangible.
There's no argument. You don't provide any argument for it. You just assert you're entitled to get this back. You don't give any reasoning. Where do you address the issue?
I believe that we argued that it was taken improperly and given to ORL by the Tennessee court, and it was applied to ORL's judgment when this court had, in fact, said that it was an intangible that belonged to that all intangibles of NLC had been acquired by GP Credit. And I believe that,
Now you say you're entitled to restitution.
Pages 44 through 46 of the main brief.
And 53, well.
44 to 46 on page.
Why did you say 53 in your table of contents?
I'm in the blue brief, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm all right, my fault. All right.
It's pages 44 through 46.
Okay, you say the district court erred in finding that it was too late for GP Credit to seek restitution. Where's your reasoning? What's the error? You never explained that.
Well, the district court declared that.
They said you were bringing this up for the first time after many years and it was too late. What was wrong? You don't offer any reasoning for why the district court was wrong in what it said.
Well, I think our argument is that the court should provide relief when it's appropriate.
The court says it's too late. This has been going on for many years,
right.
And it's too late for you to pop up and then ask for all this money back, this $181,000. Why didn't you raise it earlier?
I believe that probably, and I'm recollecting now, is that it had been the summary judgment motion in this case was pending from early 2005 through 2007. And it's my recollection that these proceedings happened after we had this pending motion. And that is my best recollection. May I address one or two other points, Your Honor?
You haven't argued it. You don't even remember it, so... Yeah, what is the most critical point you'd like to argue? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I think that the dismissal of Mrs. Nelson's 1655 case was inappropriate.
How many cases is she going to bring before we're through with this?
Well, this is the only one she's ever brought, and this is the one where ORL brought its judgment to Ozaukee County and sought to...
How many cases have you filed for... in this matter, going back to the 80s.
How many cases have I filed, Your Honor?
The lawyers for the Nelsons and GP Credit. This case has been going on since...
86.
This from 86. How many suits have you filed, have your side filed, the Nelsons and GP Credit?
Two in Tennessee, I believe. One in California. One in
Wisconsin.
Two in Wisconsin. The earlier one that was affirmed by this court and then the subsequent one by Mrs. Nelson. I believe those are the only cases that have been filed by our side.
Only wouldn't be a way to describe it, would it?
Well, I'm not going to argue that. I'm not standing up here and saying it's a simple case, because it's not.
Not only simple, but it's... when you file those many cases and in those many states, there's something wrong with the way this case is proceeding.
Right, but this case...
Why do you sue in California?
Because the land was transferred in California and Mr. Hartage is a resident of... Mr. Hartage is a resident of California and that's where he did it.
Well, that's not where the land is.
No, the land is not, but that's where the transfer occurred.
What was the outcome of the California suit?
Still pending. No, Mrs. Nelson has filed one suit, and she filed this 1655 suit in this case, and she wants to declare that, I mean, she's been drug into this suit by Mr. Hartage, and she wants to declare that her property is free and clear of his claims.
Well,
that should not have been dismissed.
The state court, the circuit court in Wisconsin, say that it was marital property?
No, this... Well...
At least that's what the decree says.
The decree says that it's marital property, but it also... She's not a defendant in that case. She was never served with a summons and complaint in that case. She's not a... She was not technically a party to that case. She was never brought in.
Nelson was a part owner, right?
What's that?
He had an interest in the real estate.
No. Mr. Nelson has no interest in any real estate.
So the real estate in Wisconsin, as your claim, is solely hers.
Well, there's certain real estate in Wisconsin that's solely GP Credit Co.'s.
What is her interest then?
She is she has a small percentage interest in GP Credit Co.
Isn't it you describe as marital property?
Well, no, it's not marital property. It's not marital property. GP Credit Co. is a separate entity.
But didn't he convey it to her in some way?
Well, but that conveyance, well, there's no... I don't think there's any evidence of a conveyance. Moreover, there's no allegation of fraudulent conveyance. There's no allegation of alter ego. Mr. Bolso's...
No allegations of alter ego?
Not in the Wisconsin case. There were in this case, and Judge Randa rejected those. Right. Judge Randa rejected those in this case, but not in the Wisconsin proceeding.
But he didn't reject it, did he, by saying that they aren't, that Nelson and GP Credit aren't alter egos?
Oh, he did.
He found that they were not alter egos?
Well, Judge Randa found they were not, and Judge...
Judge Randa.
Excuse me, you're talking about Judge Randa? He found no alter ego. He dismissed that claim.
And he dismissed the claim. I didn't.
We found insufficient evidence.
He made a finding that they were not alter egos.
Well, I don't think he specific. You're correct. He did not make that specific finding.
Well, that's kind of important, isn't it? What was the ground of his dismissal?
On the grounds that alter ego is not a separate cause of action in Wisconsin, and it's not.
That's very different from saying they're not alter egos.
I agree.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Aarons. Mr. Bolso? Maybe you could start with that issue. That's your appeal, right?
It is, Your Honor, the alter ego issue. We asked Judge Randa for a summary judgment on the alter ego claim because the Chancery Court in Tennessee had issued a judgment in favor of Orlando Residence Limited against GP Credit on the alter ego issues. It was a default judgment. It was a default judgment. There was this, the judgment arose out of this $150,000 bond that was referred to earlier, which was paid into the clerk's office down in the Chancery Court. And we filed a case down there against GP Credit asking that it be determined to be the alter ego of Mr. Nelson and that those funds be applied to our judgment. GP Credit, although properly served, failed to appear, and the court entered a default judgment. We then asked Judge Randa in this case to find on summary judgment that GP Credit was the alter ego of Mr. Nelson because that issue had already been determined in Tennessee and that ruling was now entitled to full faith and credit under the full faith and credit statute. Judge Randa declined to do that. He found that there was some inconsistency between the Chancery Court's ruling on the alter ego judgment and this court's prior ruling when this case was here in 2003. And he, because of that inconsistency, found that
at least as I recall, it's a long time ago, all I did was reread the opinion, but we didn't. Did we address an alter ego issue?
Not at all, Your Honor. No. Right. No, in fact...
Why did Judge Randa think we had said anything that bore on that? I don't...
Principally, I believe, Your Honor, because the appellants, in particular GP Credit, made that argument. They specifically made the argument that the Tennessee court had disregarded this court's ruling in 2003, and he accepted that. Now, the record, we submit respectfully to Chief Judge Randa, indicates otherwise. Chancellor Lyle accepted this court's ruling and said these funds, these $150,000 in bond proceeds, are owned by GP Credit because of the Seventh Circuit's ruling in 2003. The next question is, however, is GP Credit the alter ego of Mr. Nelson? If the answer is yes, those funds can be applied to the judgment.
Because you have a judgment against Nelson.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Could you help me out here?
I'll certainly try, Your Honor.
In your alter ego claim, you assert that the Tennessee court expressly adopted and applied this court's ruling in GP Credit and did not act contrary to any orders of this court. But I'm not sure that's true, because although the Tennessee court agreed that GP Credit's foreclosure conveyed all of the assets of NLC to GP Credit in May of 2001, including the funds at issue in the Tennessee litigation, didn't the court then reject our conclusion as to the fraudulent conveyance claim, holding that it was not persuaded by our discussion and dismissal of those claims, and deciding, and I'm going to quote, deciding not to adopt the decision of the federal courts as to Orlando's fraudulent conveyance claim. So how can you say that that's not contrary to our decision?
We say that, Judge Rovner, because this court's ruling in 2003 dealt with the intangible assets of Nashville Lodging Company and whether those assets had now become owned by GP Credit pursuant to a public sale. The Tennessee court accepted that. That's the part that I was talking about a moment ago. With regard to the fraudulent transfer, I believe the Tennessee court concluded that this court's opinion did not reach that issue.
Right.
And therefore,
right.
It was GP not...
GP won that case. Right? The metric claim...
GP won that claim. And so if we look at what the issue is with regard to the $150,000 bond, which is an issue in this appeal, we submit it's clear that the Chancery Court followed this court's ruling. In fact, the words of the ruling are that it's not necessary for the Tennessee court to replow ground that's already been plowed by the federal courts, both by the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and then in affirmance by this court.
What is the status of the metric claim?
The status is this, Your Honor. It is settled. What occurred was that...
I see. That's part of their... That's their interference argument.
It is, Your Honor.
That they settled it for less than they would have if you hadn't reminded people of the receivership or whatever... Exactly, you did.
That's their claim.
That's their
claim. What ultimately occurred was that the case was settled between GP Credit and Metric for $150,000. We waived the receivership so that settlement could occur and agreed that that money should be deposited with the Eastern District of Wisconsin, which occurred. And then after Judge Randa's ruling, my understanding is that GP Credit took that money from the clerk's office, and it has now received the $150,000 proceeds from the Metric lawsuit.
But are you trying to get that back on your alter ego theory?
We are not, Your Honor, no.
We're not. I see. So they get to keep their $150,000 Metric settlement. Is that right? GP Credit gets to keep it?
In a manner of speaking. Now, Judge McCormick...
What is that sinister qualification?
Judge McCormick has determined in the ruling that Judge Kane had in his hand a moment ago that all of the assets of GP Credit are now owned by Mr. and Mrs. Nelson.
Yes, that's what I'm wondering.
Yes.
So you actually would hope to get it back.
Exactly, Your Honor. In fact, if we look at paragraphs 6 and 7 of Judge McCormick's ruling, the $150,000 is a scheduled asset that he has ordered Mr. and Mrs. Nelson to turn over to the court to satisfy ORL's judgment against Mr. Nelson in the amount of $1.2 million. That's the state court. Yes, Your Honor.
Now, what is the nation... Could you just explain the alter ego, your alter ego theory a little more closely? So how does this arise? It started with NLC, didn't it?
It did, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was owned by the Nelsons or Mr. Nelson or what?
the assets, the bond that we're talking about, the $150,000 bond, started with NLC and moved to GP Credit as a result of this court's ruling in 2003. GP Credit itself was owned 99.98% by something called the Havenhurst Pension and Profit Sharing Plan.
Havenhurst?
Yes, Your Honor. Havenhurst. And the remaining 0.02% was owned by Mrs. Nelson. And our position had been that this was simply a concoction that the Nelsons had come up with as a way to put assets beyond the reach of creditors. They put the assets in GP Credit, and then they have the ownership of GP Credit in an entity which is an ERISA plan, and therefore, under ordinary circumstances, exempt from execution. What ultimately occurred, and the reason we believe that the GP Credit is the alter ego, is that Havenhurst was just a sham. It was, in name only, a pension plan, the trustee of which was Mrs. Nelson's sister. And the testimony provided in the Wisconsin State Court proceeding before Judge McCormick established that Mrs. Barbara Similek, Mrs. Nelson's sister, who was the trustee, didn't know anything about Havenhurst, had no idea what assets they had, didn't know where the assets were invested, had never had an idea about any of those things. And all that she knew about the plan was that from time to time, Mrs. Nelson would come to her and ask her to sign documents. And Judge McCormick found that was a sham. He goes into this in his opinion and says it was really Mr. and Mrs. Nelson that were controlling Havenhurst, which owned 99.98% of GP Credit. So if we'd actually gotten to a trial, the alter ego trial before
Chief Judge... 1%, I'm sorry?
Havenhurst owned 99.98%. Mrs. Nelson owned the remaining 0.02%. So if we'd ever gotten to trial in front of Chief Judge Randa, that would have been the case we put on, Your Honor. This was something set up just as a way of insulating assets from the reach of creditors. We asked Judge Randa to give us a summary judgment because we'd already received an alter ego ruling down in Tennessee. And although it was by default, Tennessee treats a default judgment just like a final judgment. If it is a judgment pursuant to which due process was accorded to the defendant, then it has preclusive effect. It's entitled to full faith and credit under Durfee versus Duke. And so we asked Judge Randa to award us a summary judgment. He declined to do that. But for his accepting the alter ego judgment, we probably could not have received summary judgment because there probably would have been questions of fact. But we didn't move on the underlying factual issues. We moved simply on the preclusive effect of the Tennessee judgment.
What's Aunt Ruthie's Cookies?
Aunt Ruthie's Cookies was another limited liability company formed by Mr. and Mrs. Nelson for the purpose of placing assets beyond the reach of creditors. It was an Oklahoma limited liability company. It was canceled. Its charter was canceled by the Oklahoma Secretary of State effective July 1, 2007 for its failure to pay its fees and file its reports for the preceding 3 years. After its charter was canceled and it was dissolved, the assets of Aunt Ruthie's Cookies then went directly to the Nelsons. And this, again, is something that Judge McCormick touches on in his ruling. Aunt Ruthie's Cookies was owned two-thirds by Mr. Nelson's IRA and one-third by Mrs. Nelson's individual retirement account. And what the Nelsons did, and this was borne out in the trial before Judge McCormick, was that Aunt Ruthie's Cookies was the largest depository of the Nelsons' assets. And whenever the Nelsons needed money, GP Credit would borrow the money from Aunt Ruthie's Cookies. And in this case, it borrowed approximately $2 million. Once the money got to GP Credit, then Mrs. Nelson would write checks to herself and put it into her checking account. But the same system was in play. Aunt Ruthie's Cookies was owned 100% by two IRAs. Judge McCormick found that this was both a direct and an indirect violation of the prohibited transaction rules under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 4975, and therefore disqualified both of those IRAs as qualifying IRAs that are exempt from execution under Wisconsin law. And so at this point, this entire house of cards has now come tumbling down. ARC has been canceled. GP credit was canceled for at least the last 5 months or so. And Judge McCormick has ruled that the assets of both those entities are now owned directly by Mr. and Mrs. Nelson, that they constitute marital property assets under the laws of the state of Wisconsin, and that all those assets are available to satisfy ORL's judgment. Judge McCormick has ordered a turnover of all those assets, but has stayed that part of his order, allowing the Nelsons to appeal to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Which
this order was issued last month.
It was, Your Honor. It was issued November 18, 2008.
When did the Nelsons first become involved? Were they involved with NLC or is
it? Yes, they were, Your Honor. They formed Nashville Lodging Company as a Wisconsin limited liability company in December 1986. And it was owned principally by Mr. Nelson, and the remainder of it was owned by his business associates, Terry Vogt and Mitchell Anderson.
So GP Credit is the successor to NLC, is that?
It was the successor to all of its assets. It was not, in a corporate sense, a successor, but it bought all those assets at that sale on May the 10th of 2001. And it was the creation of NLC was part and parcel of the underlying fraudulent transfer that gave rise to this $1.2 million judgment. Because what occurred was that on December the 17th of 1986, on behalf of Orlando Residents Limited, we filed a lawsuit on a promissory note against Nashville Residents Corporation, another one of Mr. Nelson's companies, that owned this hotel in Nashville. Mr. Nelson...
You were trying to foreclose, was that?
Exactly, Your Honor. We were going to obtain a judgment on the promissory note and execute against the hotel. On December 29 of 1986, Mr. Nelson formed Nashville Lodging Company, and through an unrecorded quitclaim deed, Nashville Residents Corporation transferred the land and buildings making up that hotel to this new entity, Nashville Lodging Company, which then held it until such time as it sold.
So the origin of this litigation, really 1986, suit to foreclose.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, okay, we're 22 years on. Is there some foreseeable end?
We're getting very close.
You think you're getting close?
I think we're getting very close.
You mean if Judge McCormick's order is sustained?
Exactly, Your Honor. We have all the assets tied up. We have their real property tied up. We have their tangible property tied up, personal property, their intangible personal property. And if the Wisconsin Court of Appeals just affirms Judge McCormick, the case will be remanded, the stay will be dissolved, and we will be able to execute on those assets and satisfy the judgment.
What is the total amount of money mm-hmm. that you think GP or the Nelsons owe you? Orlando.
It is almost exactly $1.2 million.
And what did it start out as?
It started out as $250,000,
yes.
A promissory note.
And that doesn't include attorney's fees, of course.
It does not, Your Honor. Unfortunately, the note did not provide for attorney's fees. And the attorney's fees in this case over the last 22 years obviously have been extreme. I know... You know, our side has probably spent over $1 million. I know that the other side has probably spent twice that based on affidavits they filed and discovery that we did when one of their companies filed a Chapter 11 bankruptcy that was ultimately dismissed. Judge Posner earlier used the word insane. I think that not only describes GP Credit's position with regard to collateral attack, but it also describes this litigation, the response to rather than paying a note for $250,000. And it was a promissory note. It wasn't as though it was some intangible claim or a claim that couldn't easily be reduced or liquidated to a specific amount. It was a $250,000 promissory note, and rather than paying it, we've been on this odyssey for 22 years. We first filed the case in 1986. The federal district court in Nashville gave a judgment of approximately $400,000 on March the 21st of 1990, which was the amount of the note plus interest. And then after we began post-judgment discovery, we determined that this hotel had been sold via an unrecorded quitclaim deed. So we had to file the fraudulent transfer action, which we did, and that went to trial first in 1995. We received a judgment. The Court of Appeals in Tennessee found that there were some problems with the court's instructions to the jury, so we had a retrial in 2000. We won that trial. And then when that went up on appeal, that court found that there's nothing wrong with the judgment, but the court should have submitted an issue of the statute of limitations to the jury. So we went back in 2004 and had that trial and won that one. And that finally became final on December the 26th of 2006, after which we then were able to come up here, come to Wisconsin, I should say, domesticate the judgment on January 11th of 2007 and begin the execution. So we hope we're getting very close to the end. We know that Judge Houston in San Diego has already rejected this collateral attack, and we've provided the court his opinion in that regard.
Well, under the pen name Dickens, one of you should write a book.
Perhaps we should, Your Honor. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Balsillo. Mr. Ahrens, your time expired, but we'll give you a couple of minutes to view the complexity of the lawsuit and...
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I want to add that, Judge, all of this discussion about the evidence in front of Judge McCormick was evidence that might have been presented to Judge Randa to oppose or to support our motions for summary judgment, and it wasn't. The only thing that was relied on for Mr. Bulsar or ORL's alter ego summary judgment was the Tennessee judgment. Judge Randa found, in addition, that there was no alter ego cause standing alone, that the Tennessee court did not have jurisdiction over the bond because the bond was an intangible and the situs of the intangible is Wisconsin. We also argued in our brief that Tennessee didn't have personal jurisdiction over GP Credit because there were no contacts and there was no way, even if we were served with a summons and complaint, there was no way that the Tennessee court could have personal jurisdiction over GP Credit. So there is that point. I do want to emphasize that the slander of title and interference claims are real. The settlement for one with Metric of $150,000 would have been a settlement of $650,000 had ORL not refused to or delayed lifting the receivership. And while they delayed, they were given notice by a letter, which we have in the short appendix. Metric said, we'll settle with you for $650,000 if the receivership is lifted. ORL delayed. Subsequent events by the Court of Appeals in Tennessee made the offer that $650,000 less. Metric withdrew that offer. So what happened was the refusal to lift that receivership.
And what exactly is your argument that they're not all that the you say the Tennessee judgment? Why shouldn't Judge Randa have relied on the Tennessee judgment that GP Credit is an alter ego of the Nelsons?
Well, what Judge Randa said was that the Tennessee court lacked in rem jurisdiction. That's on page 8 of his decision. It's in the required short of appendix of page 25. He also...
Why should that make a difference?
Well, if the court didn't have jurisdiction over the item that Judge Randa cited Klein v. Burke Construction, that it could not act with regard to that bond because the bond was in the jurisdiction of this court. He also held that he did not have to give a decision contradicted with his own. So both on the merits of the idea of an alter ego claim is not a standalone claim, and the procedural issues, Judge Randa dismissed their alter ego claim. All this recitation of facts that Mr. Bolsa has come up with and talked about came out at a hearing in October and were not in the record before Judge Randa. There's no excuse for, I mean, if ORL wanted to present them, there's certainly no excuse why they shouldn't have been presented, either in support of his motion or ORL's motion or in opposition to our motion to dismiss the alter ego claim. All of the rest of the recitation of facts by Mr. Bolso about the relationships, certainly not in the record before this court, and they are disputed.
Judge Randa's concern was that he thought the Tennessee court was inconsistent with our decision of 2002. Wasn't that his ground?
Well, I think he thought that...
Was that his ground or not?
I believe it was one of his grounds, yes.
One of his grounds? He has other grounds?
He has other grounds.
Where are they?
His decision is in our required short appendix, and the point where he addresses that is on the required short appendix in the blue brief, beginning at page 23, page 6 of his decision, and then continuing on to page 9 of his decision, or page 26 of the required short appendix. The last point is the merits point, which is perhaps I believe would be the most important, where he cites Fletcher saying that an attempt to pierce the corporate veil is not in itself a cause of action, but is a means of imposing liability.
Are you looking now?
I'm on page 26 of the appendix, page 9 of his decision.
Right.
Such as,
yes,
it's a means of imposing liability on an underlying cause of action, such as a tort or breach of contract. And he says, aside from the 2001 fraudulent transfer claim, which is barred as a matter of law, Orlando does not dispute that it abandoned its remaining fraud claims. So the alter ego is sort of hanging out there with no underlying claim. And that is a merits decision. It's a failure to literally plead the facts showing that the pleader is entitled to a claim of relief. Now, perhaps if Mr. Bolso had taken the time to put the issues in that he talks about learning in the hearing in 2008 when these motions were briefed back in 2005, the result might have been different. But he did not, and that was a strategic choice by him. He could have taken that discovery. He didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel, and we'll move.